Welcome back to Generals and Napoleon, episode 77, Napoleon III, Emperor of France. Just a quick reminder to our wonderful audience that if you'd like bonus ad-free content and previews of upcoming episodes, please go to patreon.com/Generals and Napoleon. If you'd like to support our podcast in other ways, please go to YouTube, find our podcast, and hit the subscribe button. Now, on with the show. We have a very special guest on the line with us today, all the way from Barcelona, Spain, my good friend, Melissa Rossi. Say hello, Melissa.
Hola.
Hola. Hey, thanks for joining us.
Hey, I'm thrilled to be here. I love everything Bonaparte. So I'm thrilled you're doing this podcast and I'm really happy to talk to you.
Yeah, well, it's my pleasure to have you on the line. For those of you who don't know, Melissa has a fantastic Substack. It's kind of like a blog, but it's really interesting stuff. And who are we talking about today on our little podcast?
Napoleon III, the nephew.
The nephew. Yeah, some would say the nephew who's not as famous, but might have been more impactful in the history of France, wouldn't you say?
Oh, I would say certainly. And in fact, a lot of his legacy is the infrastructure that's still there today. I mean, a lot of those train stations, those rails, the sewers, the aqueducts that bring in the clean water, yep. That was him.
Yep. And ruled France for longer than his more famous uncle.
Yes. And not only that, but he went into four continents. So he was in Asia, Africa, North America, South yep. America. So he geographically expanded far further than his uncle.
Yeah, I think a lot of people forget about that. So before we jump in, let me tell you a bit about Melissa. Like I said, she has a great Substack on Napoleon III, among other things. And the Substack is melissarossi.substack.com. She also has a series of books called What Every American Should Know About History. Could you touch on that briefly?
My first book for the series was What Every American Should Know About the Rest of the World. Okay. And then it evolved into a series. So there's What Every American Should Know About Europe, What Every American Should Know About Lobbying, whatever. You know, it morphed. But it has a lot of history in it.
Okay.
And so that's, you know, when I was looking at the history of France in particular, I was blown away.
Yeah. And people can find those books on Amazon or wherever books are sold.
Yeah.
Okay. So
I will say they're a little bit out of date as far as who's currently running countries, but the history is the history. So
if you're interested in geopolitics, they're good books and I recommend my great listeners take a look at them. And Melissa, let's dive into Napoleon III. He was born Charles Louis Napoleon Bonaparte in April 1808 to Napoleon's brother Louis Bonaparte, and that's Napoleon's younger brother, and his wife Hortense de Beauharnais, who was the daughter of Empress Josephine.
And Napoleon's stepdaughter.
Correct. And this was in Holland. They were rulers of Holland at the time. So what were his younger years like?
Well, first of all, I want to say something about their marriage.
Oh, yeah. Let's.
It was forced. Uh-huh. I mean, neither Louis or Hortense were both in love with other people. They did not really want to do it, but it was forced on them by Napoleon and Josephine because they wanted an heir and Josephine wasn't producing one. So they thought, oh, we'll take the Bonaparte blood and Beauharnais blood and we'll blend it in, you know, via Louis and Hortense. So it was a very, it was a sad marriage. And so right away she got pregnant. And Napoleon wanted to raise that kid, whose name was Charles, as his heir. But he died from croup at like age 4. So Josephine had 2 more sons. One, confusingly, one was known as the second one was Napoleon Louis. And the third one is Louis Napoleon.
Yeah.
And when, like I said, Louis was always really paranoid. So when this baby was born, the third one, he's like, you know, he's born 10 days too late. I mean, 10 days too early for it to be mine. So, and when he said that, and he already had like sentries in front of his wife's door, he'd walk her in, you know, so she just had it. And so she just left him. up in Holland and went back to Paris. And so Louis Napoleon really never knew King Louis of Holland very well at all.
So his marriage, Hortense and Louis, was more of a marriage of empire building than it was of love.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Okay. In fact, there was, I'd say no love in that one. So when Louis Napoleon was born, he was always around Napoleon. Napoleon loved him. He was a really darling child, and everybody sort of cooed over him. But he was very thoughtful too. He was known for like giving. He saw a pauper on the street one day and he gave him his boots. He was just a really dear, wonderful child. Right. And then when Napoleon fell after the Battle of Waterloo the second time, and was shipped out to St. Helena, shortly thereafter in 1816, the Bonapartes were banished from France, as you know.
Right, right.
And most of them went to Italy. So that's where Louis Napoleon was. So Louis Napoleon took custody of the second child, Napoleon Louis, and raised him.
You can see why it gets confusing. Yeah.
There's too many Louis, there's too many Napoleons, there's too many Jeromes in this family. It gets really hard to research them and also hard to write about them because you're repeating the same names over and over. But the third child goes with Hortense, who was separated from Louis, to Switzerland.
Is that Napoleon III right there?
Yes. They bought this castle manor, Ehrenberg, which remains today. I believe it's now a museum in Switzerland. But anyway, so that's where he was raised.
All right. We'll just call him Napoleon III moving forward, just so we can kind of clarify him. Was he well educated?
He could have been. You know, initially, he had excellent tutors. They were very frustrated with him because he did not apply himself. He was much more into, you know, riding. He looked good on a horse. He liked to ride a lot. Flirting up the girls. He was just a sort of a player. And just, he was not serious about his studies until, and we're going to skip ahead for one second here, until he got locked up in prison, and for 6 years he caught up on everything, and then he actually became a fairly well educated man.
I do wonder though, like you said, he basically was raised by his mother. Mm-hmm. So most of his upbringing and his character was shaped by Hortense as opposed to his dad Louis.
Very much.
Okay.
Napoleon III, as a child, this idea was implanted in his head that he was going to rule, because Hortense was really into mystics, and she had had his horoscope done and stuff like that. And everybody was like, he's going to rule. And he starts telling people all the time, you know, oh, when I'm the emperor of France, you know, everybody's like, what?
Right. It almost seems, and we're going to get to this, especially his first two coup attempts, like they were just complete pipe dream, long shot, no chance in hell type of efforts. But it seems like you were saying, like, either his mother put this, like, this idea in his head, like inception, like you are going to be great one day, or he just was believing it the whole time, and that what led to the coups. But I think that's interesting that you said that, you know, Hortense really gave him, I don't know, it's not delusions of grandeur, but that you can be greater than you think you are.
I think it would actually be delusions of grandeur.
I think
you could go that far. Also, Napoleon, before he went to Russia, so this is 1812, Louis was saying, don't go, you know, because what if you die, it would be very bad for France.
Right.
And Napoleon had turned to his aide and said, like, keep your eye on this one. Someday he may rule the French. And that made and I'm sure Hortense repeated that a million times to him too, but anyway, that made an impression on him as well.
So let's jump ahead to 1832. Napoleon the first son, Napoleon the second, dies of an illness at the young age of 21.
Tuberculosis.
Right. So people always ask me, well, why is he Napoleon the third? That's kind of why, right? Like, even though Napoleon the second dies, he gives respect to, you know, his, you know, Napoleon the second's, like, I guess, honor or memory.
Yeah. Yes. So it was memorializing, you know, initially Napoleon the third did want to be known as Napoleon the second, but out of respect for the King of Rome or the Duke of Reichstag as he was known, and who had absolutely no intention or desire to rule France. When he died, it was, so it's out of respect to him that he went with Napoleon III.
Okay, now the other interesting part about this is, now this is 1832, so this is 17 years after Napoleon's abdication and exile. Was Bonapartism still strong in France and in Europe at this time?
It's hard to assess, but there was some support. There certainly was some support, and there was some support from people in the military who had fought with Napoleon, you know, in the Battle of Waterloo. And so some people, and there, you know, this was a time when, you know, France was glorious. It was, you know, make France great again. It was held in such esteem. However, you know, in certain parts like Brittany, which is on the west of France, and where they still didn't really speak French, they spoke, you know, their language. There was a lot of resentment, even when Napoleon was alive. So it was mixed. But Napoleon III, around this time, he starts getting out this propaganda. So there was this image of, you know, oh, that's when France was great. And there were people that were in support of bringing back an emperor and wanted that same kind of greatness again.
Yeah. Yeah. And he enrolls in the Swiss army as an artillery officer, like his famous uncle was. Now, obviously, he can't enroll in the French army because he's still exiled. Mm-hmm. How is his military prowess?
Regarding how he was as a military man, he knew artillery. He knew the strategies, and he had studied. He was really into what his uncle has done, so he studied a lot of those details. However, he had no stomach for war. So literally on the battlefield, he was getting sick to his stomach. He really was. I mean, I'm not saying he wasn't brave, because he was, but it just nauseated him.
Right. Right. Yeah, I could see that. And he also writes a lot of, like you mentioned, political philosophy and pamphlets during this time. And I have a quote here. It says, "I believe that from time to time, men are created whom I call volunteers of providence, in whose hands are placed the destiny of their countries. I believe that I am one of these men. If I am wrong, I can perish uselessly. If I'm right, then providence will put me into a position to fulfill my mission." End quote. Is that, like you kind of said, delusions of grandeur, or what's, is he a pipe dreamer?
He was a pipe dreamer, but he just believed it so much. He ultimately manifested it. And I believe he wrote that right before he went his Strasbourg attempt. Earlier, maybe it was 1835, like late 1835, he meets this guy named Victor Persigny. And Persigny is a nut. He's a fanatic. He's a total Bonapartist. So he's like everything Bonaparte. Oh, we got. And so when Napoleon the Third tells him, "Oh, I'm going to be emperor," you know, Persigny's like, "Yes, you are, and I'm going to help you." And he was a propagandist and a reporter at this time. He helped him plan this. And also early, right before this attempt, he had gotten Louis Napoleon was engaged to his cousin Mathilde, and who was the daughter of Jerome. And so, but all the Bonapartes were petitioning the French king, Louis Philippe, and they kept on saying, "We're not going to try anything. Just let us come back to France," you know. But Louis Napoleon, so the future Napoleon III, has these dreams with Persigny. So they start going there. So they decide they should go to Strasbourg because it's in the east. And so they could get there they were always going into Germany, from Germany to Switzerland. So they start doing recon. And so they do find this colonel of the 4th Artillery Regiment. And he was unhappy with the French government because he wanted to be a general.
Strasbourg makes sense. Like it's far away from Paris, that it won't be crushed immediately. Maybe they could bring like a groundswell of popular revolt and then bring it to Paris, you know?
Exactly. And that's what they planned on doing. But Louis Napoleon was obsessed because when his uncle had left Elba, he said, I will take France back bloodlessly without,
right, without firing shots. Yeah.
And so Louis Napoleon was like, okay, we got to make this bloodless. Don't kill anybody. So, so he did have, when he goes in, he did have this colonel's regiment. So he had like 1,000 backers, at least okay. This is according to some accounts. The one that I believe. And so he did have that, but as they go through the town, you know, vive l'empereur, just thinking that everybody's going to bow.
Right.
It didn't turn out that way. And there was another regiment that, that would not support him. So he ended up, you know, it's just a joke. He ends up arrested and thrown in prison.
So not the way he dreamed it up.
No, but he was, but his mother Hortense begged King Louis Philippe to be lenient with him. And Louis, it was almost like he was amused by it, but he gives him a bunch of money and he sends him off. He's like, you know, you're banished to the United States. And they take the slow boat to Virginia and it takes like 4 months to get there. They stop in Brazil and whatever, you know. So finally he shows up in Virginia. And he gets a letter that Hortense is really sick with cancer. Right. And so he's only there like 8 months. Anyway, so he had to sneak back in with a fake passport to go through England and then get back to Switzerland. And so he was with her last few weeks
there. Yeah. And I think he gets a big inheritance from her after her death,
yes.
Right? Okay, yes. So now he's able to finance his great delusions of grandeur.
Yes. So he puts out a pamphlet about how great the Strasbourg attempt was, and it really riles all the power elites in Paris. and so they tell the Swiss government, you have to get rid of him or we're going to invade. And anyway, so he sets himself up sort of a martyr. But so, so then he moves to London. So he's there a few years.
Okay.
And he keeps on getting these pamphlets and he's buying up the newspapers that are the Bonapartist newspapers. So he's getting, you know, he's still working the ground there. This is probably Persigny too. And in 1840, the king, in a big PR move, because he wanted to be equated somehow with the greatness of Napoleon. He brings back the body, the remains of Napoleon, who had died in 1821. So 19 years later.
And I did read about that. Like his support was waning, King Louis Philippe. And I think that was kind of like a long shot to like bring back his support, but it didn't really work. Even though the funeral was very popular, he remained unpopular.
Yes. I mean, he was, yes. I mean, there were some economic woes at the time as well. I mean, he was not a bad guy. As kings go, he wasn't as selfish as many of them. So Louis Napoleon and Persigny again, and a couple colonels, you know, decide they're going to strike again.
Try again. Okay. Mm-hmm. How did this one go?
Well, they rented a steamer, like a pleasure steamer, and they told the guy they were going somewhere else. And anyway, and they load up like 8 horses, some carriages, and a bunch of rifles. And they're picking up people along the way. Oh, and Louis Napoleon had specially made like French army uniforms, and they had like the number 40 on the buttons. Because they were trying to pretend that when they got into town, they were going to pretend that they were part of the 40th Regiment. So anyway, they get off. Oh, they have a live eagle. So they get on the boat. They land a couple miles away. And two Coast Guard guys see them.
They land in France. Yeah.
Yes. So and this is across the English Channel. So now they're going for Boulogne, and as they're approaching, these guards seem like, who are you? And they're, oh, we're with the 40th Regiment, blah, blah, blah. And these Coast Guards don't really believe them, but they accompany them to the town. They get to the barracks where the lieutenant gets and they are winning over some people. But somehow, then the Coast Guard has told the general, I believe it's a general, I don't want to misstate
officer of some sort.
The one who's normally in charge. And they wake him up. And so you know, they're starting to get every, you know, vive l'empereur. And, but, you know, the commander comes in and he's like, no, vive le roi. The soldiers are confused. In this, somehow there's a scuffle. Of the 50 men he shows up with, they're like his servants. They're like his and the servants of his friends. So these are people, you know, most of them are not military people. They don't know what they're doing.
Right.
So anyway, a soldier gets shot, not fatally, but anyway, so all the soldiers turn against Louis Napoleon and his forces, and they run him out of town. At one point, he did get in the town. He was throwing gold coins. They're, you know, flapping the eagle around. You know, vive l'empereur. They have pamphlets, you know, right. I guess the alarm drums. There wasn't a bell. It was drums, and the National Guard and the citizens come out because these drums are beating, you know, like it's an emergency, and they chase Louis Napoleon and his troops, his servants in uniform,
entourage,
back to the water, and so there's a scramble to get to a boat. There was a small boat that they were going to take to get back to the steamer. When they get in it, it capsizes. And so he was, by some accounts, he was drowning. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so they got him.
So he's captured. And I'm sure King Louis Philippe has had enough of this clown by now. And exactly. he sentences him to life in prison in 1840.
It's actually like the Senate. Apparently he gave a very eloquent testimony, okay. But they were like, no, you know, to the prison of ham for life, you go.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Right. As you mentioned before, he makes good use of his 6 years in prison by reading and writing a lot, correct?
Yes. And he used a lot of his money he used a lot of his money on that coup attempt too. Mm-hmm. He revamped. So he had sort of a large area, but it was cold and damp. And he revamped it and turned it into like a library and a scientific lab. It was like a jail suite, pretty nice.
Right.
And, you know, and he's hanging out and playing cards and drinking wine with the warden every night.
Oh,
and
okay.
The housekeeper, he starts an affair with her. He has two kids with her.
Right.
He writes a pamphlet called The End to Pauperism. So the End of Poverty. And lays out some ideas that he did actually put into use, including making a banking system that would help the workers.
Okay.
And he also had some ideas for agricultural improvement. It was very widely read in France. And so this really planted a seed for what would happen later. So he's not very good at his coup attempts, but he is a caring, intelligent man that's going to take care of us.
And I think we'll touch base on that, on his legacy later, because I think he did a lot for the poor of France and under his empire. So we'll come back to that. I do want to talk about his escape from prison, because that's kind of a story in itself. How did that go down? If you can briefly summarize that one.
Well, he was in the prison with this doctor, Dr. Canot, and Dr. Canot's like, oh, Louis's sick. And so they don't let the guards in that day, or saying, oh, he's too ill. He can't see anybody. And in the meantime, Louis has like, I'm trying to remember, did he shave off his mustache or whatever? He sums up how disguised his looks, and he has a construction worker's outfit. So he just walks out of the prison like a construction worker. And then, you know, he went to Belgium first, and then he went to England.
Okay. Yeah. That's just a funny little story. Cause like you said, like, you know, he's playing cards with the warden. It doesn't sound like he was being too strict kept in this prison, you know?
No, he, I mean, for, you know, yeah, a lot of the people back then, I'm surprised almost all the Bonapartes were in prison at one point or another, but, you know, but not for that long.
Yeah. Even Napoleon himself was in prison for a little while, but we jump ahead to 1848 because, well, he has a long story, but because things start to look brighter for Napoleon III.
Right.
What happens when King Louis-Philippe abdicates in the face of a revolution?
So they get rid of the king in 1848, and Second Republic starts. They have a new constitution, and they grant universal male suffrage. Mm-hmm. So because of all his propaganda efforts, you know, here he's mostly in London at this time. You know, so we have this guy that speaks French with a thick German accent because that's what he had learned in Switzerland. Right. He's an escaped convict from French prison. He's living in London with this courtesan, and he is the first elected president of France.
Yeah, it's shocking. And I, his opponents sometimes ridiculed him, one comparing him to, quote, a turkey who believes he's an eagle, end quote. But reading up on it, it seems like his opponents were either extreme left or extreme right. And he was kind of in the middle. And he also had the army supporting him due to his ties with the glory of Napoleon. Mm-hmm. Did his opponents just underestimate this guy?
They thought he was a cretin. Almost all the people in the parliament at the time are the major politicians. But they were like, we're only going to have to suffer this fool for 4 years because the new constitution said you could only have a four-year term for 4 years. And so early on, though, he meets two people that are important. One is Victor Hugo. He promises him the position of education minister. Right. But he gives it to somebody else. So Hugo, who's also a parliamentarian, joins this faction of people that block everything that the prince president wants to do. Yep. And he also meets early on in his presidency, his mysterious, he didn't know existed, half-brother, Charles Duc de Mornay.
Yep.
And he's a very popular, he's well-known, he's really well-connected, really rich businessman. Mm-hmm. And it's when he brings his half-brother into his scheme, that's what made it stick.
Yeah, I think that's the interesting part. That, like you said earlier, they're like, oh, we'll just have to, you know, deal with this guy for 3 or 4 years. But what I think was smart on Napoleon III's part is he's building his power base during this time. He's not just some figurehead sitting there doing nothing. Like he's really organizing his power.
Yes, but he couldn't get anything done. You know, what he ended up doing was he fulfilled a lot of Napoleon's unfulfilled goals. And one of those was to renovate France. And he couldn't get anything. So in 1851, he's been in there 3 years. He hasn't gotten anything done, you know, and he can't run again.
Right. So what he does do is he initiates a coup d'etat to retain his power and prevent another election. And is soon after declared emperor. I mean, that's just what an amazing turn of events, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but initially he told everybody, I think he even put this, had a referendum on this one. You know, I'll be president for 10 years. So that was the initial thing. And then later in 1852, he's like, no, I will be emperor. But there was a problem because he had this Harriet Howard, who was rich, and she really bankrolled. Because when he went back to London the second time, he didn't have as much money. She was bankrolling a lot of this effort.
Right.
So when he's declared emperor, when he declares himself emperor in 1852, in December, he needs a wife.
Yeah, let's talk about Eugenie, who he marries not long after he becomes emperor, 1853.
She was really into fashion. She was a Spanish countess or a Spanish noble, shall we say. She was considered a great beauty at the time. She was not his first choice. They were sending out feelers all over the place for actual princesses. And they're like, nope, you can't marry that one. You know, nobody wanted to gamble on this new empire. So anyway, but she was willing. So he got rid of the courtesan and sent her off, made her a countess, sent her off to a castle, and woos and quickly marries this Eugenie, the de Montillo.
And they had a number of kids, though, correct?
No, only one.
Only one. Okay.
And that was like 3 years later. So they married in 1853. Louis Napoleon, or Napoleon, you know, the imperial prince, was born 3 years later in 1856.
Well, let's talk about, you know, he's in control now. How were his foreign policy efforts? It seems like they were successful at first. Crimean War was a victory for France and the Allies. And he had success in Italy. So it seems like his empire started off on the right foot.
You know, you could say that it made France very the most powerful military in Europe. But, you know, a lot of these wars, I mean, and he sort of got into the Crimean thing. It didn't really affect France. He just wanted a victory and to say, we're back in the game.
Right.
In Solferino, I mean, that was one of the Italian battles. That was a slaughter. I mean, it was horrible. In fact, this businessman is going to look for him because he went something about water rights in Algeria, and comes across tens of thousands of men on the battlefield, you know, injured and screaming, and founds the Red Cross as a result of that. And the Geneva Conventions and things came out of that. I mean, so a lot of his military efforts, I think, you know, and the whole thing is seizing Mexico.
Yeah.
In some ways, like his foreign policy, he made friends with Queen Victoria. You know, he was friends with King Emmanuel of Italy. He was, you know, he was making France much more friendly, you know, had more allies than it did under his uncle's time.
Right.
But these would fall off because he made so many errors and bad choices. What he was doing from the very start, though, his biggest priority was renovating Paris.
Yeah. So, yeah. And he did, I mean, Napoleon, and his uncle, had done some renovations because, I mean, before that, it was like a medieval town. But I know we're talking now 50 years after, or 40 or 50 years after Napoleon I, right? So, I mean, you know, the streets needed widened. Like you said, the public works needed improved. What happened there?
He put in wide boulevards. Now, some people say this was so the military could control the population, so they wouldn't have these barricades where they were always fighting the government from.
Right.
These hidden. But anyway, so he brought in. So he made this new. If you've been to Paris, all of the buildings have this like beige. There's beige stone, and they all have wrought iron balconies, and they all have mansard roofs.
They're beautiful.
And this was from this era when he hired Baron Haussmann to be his administrator to make Paris the capital of capitals.
Mm-hmm.
And they put in a lot of parks, Bois de Boulogne, the Tuileries, the gardens there turned into places where the public could hear concerts, as captured in a Manet painting. Suddenly, there were all these open spaces. He was very much influenced by his time in London. So
right.
So he was trying to create like the Hyde Parks for Paris, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And they were incredibly popular. So from this closed medieval warrens, rat warrens, you know? Most of Paris became, you know, open and with this grand architecture, you know, and he's building new train stations and new markets. And this was a big deal. He lays down, like at the beginning of his reign, there were like, I don't know, like 3,000 miles of rail. By the end of it, there's like 15,000. So it's, you know, rails going in all over the place, telegraph wires,
right?
You know,
right.
Photography is taking off. He's backing the sciences. He's backing Louis Pasteur.
Right.
He gets involved with the Suez Canal.
Yeah.
And it was only completed because of Napoleon III. So
yeah, he's really modernizing the country. I read something that he found Paris stinking and left it gleaming, or something like that. Like, he really did a lot to not only improve the country but Paris itself.
Yes, they called him the magician emperor. Because what he was doing was just so, it just had changed it so much. He also had two world fairs, like international exhibitions. I'm trying to remember the exact name, but anyway, they were like two world fairs, and brought in, you know, so you were seeing like not only the architecture of China and Japan, but, you know, technological advances. And they, right. It's where the first hydraulic elevator was shown. And so all these, you know, there's all, Paris becomes the magnet of the, a magnet for the rich and the wealthy everywhere. So ambassadors are all vying to come there. You know, Playboy princes want to come there. There's beautiful restaurants, you know, it's got the best opera. It's got the best ballets. It's got the best, you know, it's got racetracks, you know, and casinos come into France.
Yeah. And I've been to Paris, and you can almost, when you're out those outdoor cafes, you can almost close your eyes and kind of go back in time.
Yes. So all the infrastructure, really, the bulk of the infrastructure in Paris was put in during this period of Napoleon III. And he gets pretty much no credit for that.
Yeah. Yeah. He should. We'll come back to that on the legacy talk. Let's talk about now, you know, just like his uncle, there was a decline of the empire and in the emperor's health. It seems he had chronic pain in his legs and feet from his times as a prisoner. He also smoked heavily. Was he kind of in the 1860s, was he in decline similar to his empire?
Yeah. And, you know, you can really say that it wasn't until like 1867, 1860, you know, that Mexico thing plays into this too. Yes, he was, but he had kidney stones. Mm-hmm. And I believe he had gallstones too. He had a lot of stones. But yes, he was getting really sick. Mm-hmm. And so he was also really worried that he was going to lose it. You know, this great dream world that he had created from the very beginning, because of what the astrologer had told his mother long before, that it would end in disaster. So he was worried.
Yeah. And during this time, Prussia is becoming a rising force in Europe and a threat to France's power on the continent. And I think almost, yes. Well, like, in my opinion, why do you think Napoleon III went to war with Prussia in 1870?
I think it was, this is, you know, you were asking me about what I thought about Eugenie. Well, she was Spanish and very devout. And so there was something that should not have really concerned France at all. But they wanted to put Hohenzollern. Yeah, yeah, I have a hard time with that word, that name. Which was the royal house that was the king of Prussia was from this. They wanted to put one of his relatives on the Spanish throne, and mm-hmm. Protestant. And so Eugenie was very upset about this. Mm. And, you know, of course, she had his ear. There was an incident where the French ambassador saw the Prussian king in a beach town and said, you know, we want to make sure that you will never put one of your relatives on the Spanish throne. Will you guarantee that? Mm-hmm. And the king said, yeah, I'm not going to guarantee it. So this is conveyed to the diplomats or whatever. But Otto von Bismarck gets a hold of this and turns it into that French ambassador said they were gonna, that France would go to war over this, and it got exaggerated in this Ems telegram.
Yeah.
And it was a trick. It was a trick. Yeah. Because at this point, France militarily was just overextended, you know, and
they're all over the world at this time.
Yeah. So he had just pulled them back from Mexico in 1867. And so they had, you know, they were going all over the place. It was just, it was scattered, mm-hmm. you know, he was like, again, with his foreign policy, what are you doing? Yeah. So they were not the same force that they were when in Crimea, you know, and Bismarck knew this.
Yeah. They go to war in 1870. Spoiler alert, it did not go well for France. And despite his declining health, Napoleon III goes to the front to inspire his army.
Yeah.
How did that work out?
It was stupid. It was just, I mean, it's just like, you're going, what? What would you? And he was really sick.
Yeah,
he had the, I don't remember, it was the gallstones or the kidney stones. He was very, very ill. And, you know, but he wanted to make this appearance. And, you know, within 2 months, it was over.
Yeah,
and it just took down the Second French Empire overnight.
Yeah, and they're, I mean, decisively beaten quickly in the Franco-Prussian War.
Painfully.
And his empire goes up, like you said, almost overnight. It's he's captured by the Prussians and his army is destroyed. What happens kind of after that? What were his final years like?
Well, let's go back to Paris, because this has a lot to do with his legacy. Sure. So they start the Third Republic. And the Third Republic, for reasons that I just don't understand, decides that they're going to continue the war against Prussia.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so Prussia has Paris surrounded.
Yeah,
and the siege of Paris, nothing could get in or out, mm-hmm. and so the people, they are reduced to eating rats,
mm-hmm.
you know, and this really, you know, they blamed him for that fall in a way that nobody. Or few blamed Napoleon and Waterloo, you know, they just were so upset that it was such a horrible siege
mm-hmm.
that, and then it turns into a sort of localized civil war in Paris. And, you know, so in the meantime, he's gone to England.
Yeah.
And so he was in England for 3 years, but he's just getting, I mean, he's getting trashed. Yeah. You know, in Paris. And the Third Republic blamed everything on him.
Right.
Victor Hugo comes back and writes another thing. And it's just scathing about, yeah. you know, the crime of the Second French Empire. And he'd been in exile all along writing these really critical things.
And Napoleon was the first Waterloo was an awful battle. But I think there was a humiliation to the Battle of Sedan, which really upset France. And I think that's what you're kind of referencing with Hugo, is that there was something about that loss. It was so total and devastating and surprising that it took France a long time to get over.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, there was the same way that propaganda had gotten him into power. Now there's like negative propaganda.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, he didn't do anything. It was all Haussmann. And it was really Louis Napoleon's vision. And mm-hmm. and again, but he was taking a lot of his ideas from his uncle, from Napoleon. You know, mm-hmm. it's just like stuff that Napoleon didn't have time because he was too busy fighting to get around to.
Right. And it's just tragic. You know, he basically lives out the rest of his life in England as a sick man and dies in 1873.
Yeah, 3 years after this, that stupid war he got into
yeah.
because of Eugenie, if you ask me. So yeah, it's really quite sad.
So this question then is tricky one. What do you think his legacy is?
I think his legacy to what's really there, what is not widely acknowledged, is modern Paris is mm-hmm. his legacy.
Mm-hmm.
The interconnected trains are his legacy. The mm-hmm. modern, well, they're not for that era. The industrial, I mean, he was helping the Industrial Revolution. He really brought France up to speed. The Suez Canal that right. he funded the completion of, the Red Cross that he funded the creation of. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are just a few of the things. Oh, and margarine. I can't forget that, because he was concerned that the poor couldn't afford butter.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a scientist like develop margarine.
Yeah. And I think he did a lot for, like you said, the poverty stricken areas of Paris and France. And he doesn't get enough credit for some of his efforts.
Yeah. And what he also did was, I could tell you, wild story. He made loans available for the workers and for the lower middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of small businesses grew up because of this.
Right.
And the guilds could fund new projects. So there was a lot of energizing, a lot of enterprises that these were funded. And I'll tell you a real quick story here. There was a guy, a farmer from Central France, and it was a bad crop year. He had to walk to Paris to become a stone cutter, a day worker.
Mm-hmm.
So it took a few days to walk to Paris. So he camped out overnight in the woods. And when he woke up in the morning, he realized that there was a quarry that had not been discovered.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was on thinking, I'm going to buy this quarry. He makes a map. On his deathbed, he gives the map. He's never mentioned this to anybody. He gives the map to his son. And mm-hmm. he says, son, you got to buy this quarry. During the financing part of this Second French Empire, the son got a loan, bought the quarry. And the stones from that quarry became Sacré-Cœur.
No, no way.
The beautiful church in Montmartre. And yeah. They also renovated. I mean, there was so much devastation after the localized civil war in 1871 that there was a lot of, so suddenly all these oxen are coming up from central France. But things like that, he made possible.
Yeah, it strikes me like, I mean, if you want to count 1848 as part of his rule too, like, you know, he ruled the country well for 22 years. Yes, he made a terrible mistake in 1870 going to war, mm-hmm. but it's almost like he doesn't get appreciated for those 22 years of relative peace and prosperity. He just gets blamed for that one mistake in 1870.
I was just having a conversation with a Frenchman. It's like, he's given no credit. Really, yeah. No credit.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I think there should be more research in articles. If you want to go to melissarossi.substack.com. You can find some of those articles. And there's also subscriptions there if you want to get really in detail, correct?
Yeah. So there's free subscriptions where you get like some gratis articles and half an article. And I hope it's an interesting half of an article. And then there's paid subscriptions where you get the whole article, and I don't know. I try and be, you know, egalitarian.
Yeah.
But when people are paying, I want them to have a little bit more than the non-paying. But anyway, so it's really fun. It's all these aspects of the Bonapartes that are forgotten.
But yeah, wrapping up, Melissa, that was a fabulous episode. If you want to learn more about Melissa, like I said, you can grab one of her books on Amazon or check her out on melissarossi.substack.com. And yeah, it was a pleasure having you on the show today.
I was thrilled to be asked. This is the most interesting topic in the world to me, let me tell you. You know, and like you said, there's so many aspects to it.
Yeah, well, it really comes through and you convey it very well. So I thank you very much and we'll talk soon.